Hi there, and welcome to episode 317 of the Ski Podcast. I'm your host, Ian Martin, and today is the fourth in our series of Chamonix stories. If you are a regular listener, you will know that I was lucky enough to spend 2 months in Chamonix last winter. Episode 313 was a special on what makes the resort so special, from history to high mountain, glaciers to guides. But as I was interviewing people from around the valley, it soon became clear that I couldn't tell all their stories within that single episode. And so this series came together. I have 6 Chamonix stories to share with you, all touching on different elements of what makes Chamonix so special. In today's episode, I'm joined by David Webster. Now, you might not recognise his name, as David is better known by his YouTube identity of Chamonix Ski Bum. He has almost 10,000 subscribers and 1.7 million views on his channel. We discuss his background in skiing, what drew him to Chamonix, and how he became an influencer. David was super interesting to talk to, and I guarantee you, you will be looking up a bunch of his videos by the time you finish listening to this episode. So settle back and listen to the fourth of our Chamonix stories.
Right, I'm delighted to be joined by David Webster, also known as Chamonix Ski Bum, from the YouTube channel of the same name. Hi, David, how are you?
I'm good, thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. I've really enjoyed watching a lot of your videos in the lead up to my visit to Chamonix and while I've been here as well. Can I just ask you, whereabouts are you based, David?
So I'm currently based in Lafayette, which is technically part of Saint-Gervais. So it's where the main train station is at the bottom of the hill. I've been here for probably 2 years now, I think. I did initially live up in Chamonix for 3 years, hence why the channel is Chamonix Ski Bum. But like a lot of people, I've been forced out of the valley for financial reasons.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a lot of the people who I know who've lived in Chamonix have moved down to Servoz or Passy or Ched, etc. because of the house prices, some of them living in Saint-Gervais-les-Bains a little bit higher as well. And I'm really interested in that side of things. You clearly are a Chamonix expert. And I think these days, if you think about the Mont Blanc Unlimited Pass, it covers so many different resorts. It really is more than just Chamonix. But I'm really interested to just find out, if we can, to start off with, a little bit about your background. I wondered when you first skied and whereabouts that was.
Well, my first ever ski holiday actually was when I was about 1, maybe even less than 1, quite close to here in the Clusa. My mum actually just recently dug out a picture of me on my dad's back on one of those old school child carrier frames, which is probably frowned upon now. But yeah, back in the day, it was normal to take a baby on your back while skiing. So yeah, my first ever ski experience, I was 1, if not less than 1, over here in the Clusa. And then after that, virtually all of my skiing growing up was either on dry slopes in the UK, in England, or up in Scotland. As soon as I could walk, I was on little plastic skis.
I love that. I was out in the Clusa last week, a great place to take kids. So I just wanted to track back. What dry slopes were you skiing on when you were younger then?
So I'm from Swindon, so Gloucester is the closest for me. Also got memories of skiing in Cardiff as well. So my family's from the Cardiff area on my mum's side. So I skied the Cardiff dry slope and also, is it Pontypridd or the Pontypool? Can't remember which one.
Nice. I've skied on both of those, Gloucester dry slope, where Eddie the Edwards Eagle originated from or had his first turns as well. But you said you also skied in Scotland. So you're not like living near Scotland. I guess the fact that your parents took you skiing when you were 1 indicates they were super keen on it. I've been to Scotland a couple of times. I've been rained on, blown around by the wind, etc. Is that your memory of holidays up in Scotland?
Oh, absolutely. You get all 4 seasons in a day, but you get a lot of rain, a lot of wind when you're skiing up in Scotland. So it takes a very much a hardy person to enjoy it. But yeah, that was all I knew for many years. So I grew up skiing in the wind and the rain on little thin strips of slush surrounded by heather. That's my grounding in skiing.
I can relate to that. My most recent trip to Scotland, I think, was in 2023. Went ski touring with my brother, guided by an excellent guy called Blair Aitken from British Backcountry Guides. And he went through everything, but we did get a few turns on the snow, and it's just like such a beautiful environment up there. So it sounds like skiing has been in your history the whole time, and you're living out in the Alps now. But your first work seasons, I think, in Courchevel, was it always inevitable that you were going to go and do a ski season? Did you have that in mind?
Oh, it was very spur of the moment. So I'd spent most of my life up to that point basically being a student. Like most people won't know, but I've actually got a PhD. So I spent 5 years studying up in Glasgow doing a PhD. And it just so happened that when everything finally wound down for that, it was probably mid to late October. the ski season's just coming up. I needed a break, as you probably expect after 5 years of doing the same thing over and over again. Yeah, I just quickly trawled around, found a job very last minute in Courchevel. I was looking all over the Alps. That just happened to be the one job that I got. So that's where I ended up. Basically, as soon as I left Glasgow, a few days at home in Swindon and straight to Courchevel.
Nice. I mean, I've got a lot of questions from that. I've got to ask you what the PhD was in.
So I'm a geologist, so earth science, geology, specifically thermochronology, which is the same principle as carbon dating, but with much older stuff.
Actually, that's interesting because I think from having watched a bunch of your videos, that knowledge comes through because there is that understanding of the mountains, etc. Okay, next question. What year was it that you went to Courchevel then? What year was this happening?
I've lost track of time a little bit now, but I think it was seven or eight winters ago, I think.
So it was prior, you know, back in the days when we were still members of the EU and it was relatively easy to get a job like that. So, you know, I've worked Four Seasons in the Three Valleys. What did you think of that ski area?
I absolutely loved it. I mean, it is the biggest interlinked ski area in the world and it shows you can ski all day, right? Ever skiing the same piece twice if you want to. You can go on a huge journey. I lived in the Courchevel Valley, which is one side. So you can ski all the way over to Val Thorens or Orel even. And back again in the same day if you're quick. You're going on a proper journey. Every valley has got its own different character. There's plenty to see and do, and everything's always different.
It's very different from Chamonix. I mean, I was over in Courchevel at the weekend, and I was looking at the view and thinking, well, you know, this is all, you know, very nice, but it's not as dramatic as Chamonix. But I think you started, you know, producing videos on YouTube while you're out there in Courchevel. And, you know, a lot of the features of your videos are the alpinism side of things, the ski mountaineering. I saw, you know, maybe a couple of videos of the couloirs in Courchevel. If you're looking for challenging skiing in the Three Valleys, you know, where were you heading to?
Well, so the obvious place is the Solaire couloirs, basically right underneath the big cable car that runs up between Courchevel and Mirabel. And you've got couloirs on both sides. Like the infamous one on the Courchevel side is the Grand Couloir, and on the Mirabel side is the GoPro Couloir. Those are technically pistes, but then either side of both of those, you've got lots of off-piste versions as well, and they're all super easy access, and they bring you back out onto the same piece that the Grand Couloir and GoPro Couloir bring you out on.
Any other areas of the Three Valleys that you know, like to explore in terms of, you know, more challenging stuff?
And so one of the other videos that you might have seen is in Courchevel 1650. There's a short hike from the top of one of the lifts up there, so it's still in bounds. You got to hike up a little way onto a ridge line, and then there's a bit of a very easy scramble, but an exposed scramble into a hidden couloir. That, again, that gave you several different options from that point for wider, steeper, narrower, etc.
So you did switch to Chamonix, and I think that, you know, there's that sense that, you know, the mountaineering, the ski mountaineering side of things has always been important to you. Is that a factor in that, in terms of moving from Courchevel to Chamonix?
I think the main reason is quite simply that if you want to be basically a year-round seasonaire, which is what I ended up becoming, Chamonix is the only place to do it. It is the only true mountain town in the Alps, with the exception of maybe Innsbruck, where you can actually live year-round and exist year-round and still live a life like a ski bum, like a seasonaire.
Yeah, that makes sense. And in terms of, you know, mountaineering, do you have a background in that? I'm thinking possibly your parents were clearly very into skiing. Were they, you know, into exploring the mountains as well?
So we've always done hill walking since I was a kid. I started climbing indoors when I was about 10, just in my local sports centre. But then didn't start proper mountaineering until I went to university as an undergraduate in Cardiff. I'd always wanted to do that kind of thing. My parents were outdoorsy and they were outgoing, but they weren't mountaineers or climbers, so they couldn't give me that experience themselves. So it wasn't until I could join a university group that I actually started doing proper technical mountaineering.
You know, Chamonix evidently is a haven, a paradise for those type of experiences. You know, once you moved here, you got the opportunity to do what we might call some more testing ski mountaineering. I know that some of the videos I really enjoyed was, for example, the Cosmique off the Aiguille de Midi. Do you recall the first time you did that?
I can't remember when exactly the first time would have been. It would have been definitely after COVID. Obviously, that's one of the most iconic and obvious steep ski descents you can do in the Chamonix area. You can see it looking up from the valley. So it's definitely on my radar from very early on.
When you were doing these initial descents, you skiing them with a guide? Because my only experience of, you know, anything significantly backcountry is to go out with a guide where I can kind of put my faith in them that we're doing the right thing.
No, I've never skied with the guys at all, either paid or just casually. Often doing things with friends who may well have done them before. But equally, once you've been here a few years, and I am a mountaineer as well, I've been in a lot of these places in summer. I know the terrain. I've got the skills to get myself into them and also, if necessary, out of them. So I have also done things on my own, or I've done things when I am the most experienced in the party, even though I've never done them before.
Yeah, I've watched a number of your videos and you're talking about the skills. One of the skills when you're taking on steep couloirs like this, where you might have to rappel in, is putting your skis on. And I watched one video where you did that. If you can't do that safely, then nothing is going to work, is it?
Well, exactly, yeah. It's very much an intimidating thing to be doing, trying to transition from the safety of your crampons if you've climbed up, or the safety of your rope, even if you've rappelled down onto your skis. There's obviously a period between the two where you're, for all intents and purposes, very unsafe. But obviously, you need to make yourself as safe as possible to do it. My method is not necessarily the only way, or even necessarily the best way, but it's a way that worked for me, so I thought I'd share it.
And do you want to just elaborate on that in case people haven't watched the video?
Well, so the most important thing is digging yourself a nice big platform, making yourself as stable and secure as possible, even if that takes you half an hour. Get your ice axe out and kick away with your feet and your crampons. Dig a nice big stable platform that you can get most of your ski let out on the platform, or at the very least, the tail dug into the snow at one end and the front end of the ski on the flat of the platform. Obviously, try and do as much flap as you can where you've still got your bag on your back. Then once you take your bag off your back, put your bag between you and the snow, and again, do all the faff that you can in that one time, rather than constantly taking your bag on and off and on and off again. And then just take your time. Make sure you do everything deliberately and carefully.
I mean, it makes sense. It sounds so easy. I'll put a link in the show notes to that. You've obviously done quite a few challenging ski descents. What would you say is the most challenging ski descent that you've done?
So the couloir I'm skiing there in that video, the Jaeger couloir, I think that is technically the steepest thing that I've skied in terms of sustained gradient. That averages about 55 degrees, if you believe the guidebook, which is very extreme on the scale of extreme skiing. But thankfully, when I was doing it, the snow was pretty friendly. In terms of skiing down, it was very hard work on the climb up, but it was powdery, at least on one side of the couloir, which always makes things nicer when you're trying to ski very steep things. Probably the most extreme experience I've had, I think, would be the Col du Plan North Couloir, where you're skiing off the north face of the Gui de Midi into the void, almost, off of the Midi Arête, similar to if you're doing the Mallory Porter, but a bit further along to the skier's right, along the ridge. And then basically you need to find your way into this narrow couloir via, again, more abseils. But we ended up on the wrong abseils, had to do a very sketchy rappel off of quite thin ice to get back into the right position. And even after that, it's still a very intense and extreme experience. So I think in terms of the experience as a whole, that was definitely the most extreme thing I've done, the most intense experience I've had on skis, even though the average gradient of that descent isn't quite as steep as the Jaeger couloir, for example.
I mean, that sounds terrifying. You know, it's a terrible day in Chamonix today. There's clouds sitting all over the mountain. But from where I'm sitting, normally I can see the Aigle du Midi and Mont Blanc. And I often have my binoculars out looking at people going down the Arête. And I see a few people touring up, you know, probably having left the Grand Moulier hut, or people climbing Mont Blanc. And what you're describing there sounds absolutely terrifying. Another video of yours I watched is what maybe termed the Cunningham or Passerelle couloir, which is a pretty outrageous act from the start. I wondered if you could just explain about that.
Yeah, so that's the famous couloir that runs basically underneath the bridge from the Gui de Midi. So back in the day when I did it, which wasn't all that long ago, only I think two or three seasons ago, the direct method was to rappel from the bridge itself. So you're hanging in free space underneath the bridge for virtually a full rope length, so 55 meters or so, until you reach the snow. So, of course, you've got all the spectators watching you from the bridge and from the galleries in the Gui de Midi, which adds to the pressure. And you've often got people following you behind you as well, abseiling down on top of you, which means you've got to be quick and efficient. Again, when we did it, luckily the conditions were about as perfect as they could be. It was good snow. It wasn't so deep that you need to worry about your slough too much, but it was deep enough that you could comfortably stand in it without teetering on your edges. It's iconic. It's nowhere near as extreme as it looks when you're looking down from the bridge. Once you're in there, it's steep, but by Chamonix standards, it's not that steep. It's somewhere between 40 and 45 degrees most of the way.
I love that. It's by Chamonix standards is a, you know, changes everything, doesn't it? Am I right that maybe that featured in Blizzard of Oz, or am I imagining that one?
I've not seen the whole film, so I can't guarantee that, but I wouldn't be surprised if it has.
Well, you mentioned the Aigle du Midi. I mean, that is, you know, going off the bridge, which very few people would have done. I would say much more accessible is the Vallée Blanche, which I know that you've done several times, including only a week ago. And I know quite a few listeners to the podcast have done the Vallée Blanche. I think it's probably the most watched video on your channel. I'm interested. You've been in Chamonix for 7 or 8 years. Would you say that you've seen changes in the Vallée Blanche due to climate change on the Mer de Glace, you know, during that time?
Oh, absolutely. Every single season, you can really notice a difference the first time you come down, how much the glacier has receded. And equally, just glaciers are living, breathing things almost. They change day to day, but especially year to year. So not just the glacial retreat, which is very shocking and very obvious as you're down the lower portion on the Mer de Glace, but even up on the mountain, the seracs move, crevasses move, everything changes. One season you might go down a pitch, which is perfect snow. The next year you get there, it'll just be bare rock, or it might be overhanging serac, so an overhanging block of ice, so it's completely unskiable. It changes every day, and especially every season, both through climate change and just through the natural movement of the ice.
Evidently, that is one of the things that I can personally relate to, having done the Vallée Blanche. I also started skiing at a relatively young age, perhaps not quite as young as you. I was lucky enough to ski the Vallée Blanche when I was just a kid back in the 80s. And when we skied it, we basically came out off the end of the Mer de Glace, having done the Vallée Blanche. We came out by the Buvette and skied back down to Chamonix from there. Now, that's completely not possible these days, is it?
Well, yes and no. So in a good winter, you can still ski down to Chamonix. It just has a lot more walking down than it used to. Certainly for a couple of weeks this season, people were skiing all the way down through the glacier snout, through the moraine, to the place where you then have to walk up to the Buvette. Like, it is now quite a walk, at least 20 minutes. But obviously, it's not getting any longer year on year now because the ice is already gone from there. You are at the bottom of the valley now, regardless. So that section of walking up to the Buvette isn't going to change much in the indefinite future. And then from there, in good snow, you can ski all the way, but you rarely have good snow all the way down to town these days. There's often sections of walking required now.
You mentioned, you know, how the glacier is changing the whole time. It would be changing the whole time, regardless of climate change or not. And you're saying that, you know, Wrigley ski, you know, on your own, you've skied it a bunch of times, but crevasses move, seracs move, etc. Have you ever had any issues, any problems? I mean, I was listening to an interview with a friend of mine recently who fell into a crevasse on her first ever trip on the Vallée Blanche, which was pretty bad luck because she didn't follow her guide's tracks.
Similar with me, but not me personally, but my very first trip down the Vallée Blanche, my friend fell in a crevasse. So we were skiing as a three, and one of the three, he went in a crevasse. When you're skiing on the glacier, you'll ski it in pitches. So in theory, you can always see each other all the time. He was the middle man in our group, but we skied this pitch. I got to the end of the pitch. The front man was there and the middle man wasn't. So we had no idea where he'd gone. But amazingly, he still had 4G signal on his phone. So he was able to call us and say, "Help, I'm in a crevasse." So we had to go back up, work out which crevasse he was in, get the rope out, et cetera, and haul him out. He'd obviously mentally shaken, but physically perfectly fine. So he's very lucky.
Well, I'm delighted to hear there was a positive ending to that one. Let me just track back then. You know, so you are Chamonix Ski Bum on YouTube. When did you decide to become a YouTuber?
I've never really decided to become a YouTuber. It still feels quite strange to me that I am effectively one now. It just kind of happened almost organically. I started the YouTube channel during the COVID season, not the actual first lockdown, but the year after, when we had a degree of freedom, but all the lifts were closed, all the shops were closed, all the bars were closed. So I couldn't work. You couldn't ski in resort, but you could still go skiing. And also during that time, I started product testing a pair of Elan skis, which people will have seen on many of my videos. Again, that was just purely by chance. I saw an advert on Facebook and I was perfectly placed to be testing a lightweight touring ski, as I could ski every day, but there were no lifts. So it was a pretty easy sell for me to be able to test those skis. Part of the deal with testing the skis is that we obviously promote them on social media with photos and videos. So I started making videos. Initially, I just posted them on Facebook, pretty low quality, but I thought, well, I'm making these videos, I may as well put them on YouTube, make them higher quality and make them a bit better. And it just kind of took off from there. Initially, very slowly, I was only getting a few hundred views. And then probably 18 months or so after I first started doing that was when I had my first little viral moment. But even then, I had one or two videos which had loads of views, all the rest were still getting a few hundreds. There's like a benchmark where you can start earning money on YouTube. It took me probably 3 years to get there, but it wasn't until I got there that I thought, right, I can actually, wouldn't call it a career, but I can make a pseudo living out of this.
Well, now you've got 9,000 subscribers, 1.7 million views on the channel across the board. What was the viral video then that was the tipping point, let's say?
So the first one, I think it was just a random skiing up on the Mer de Glace of the Valley Blanche in summer, like a Midsummer's Day ski on the across the Valley Blanche and back. And I know exactly why it happened as well. It coincided with the USA basically reopening their borders after the COVID pandemic and everything. So their citizens could both leave the country and come back. And virtually the day that happened, that video just spiked. All of a sudden, all these Americans must have started Googling skiing Chamonix, trying to book their ski holidays. And that video went from a few hundred views to 20,000 in a few days. That was very clearly a catalyst.
And, you know, when you're creating a video, you know, evidently, I guess there's a certain base, but can you kind of predict which videos are going to get more views? Can you know, have a sense, or do you end up spending loads of time trying to create one thinking this is really going to work and it just doesn't fly at all?
I've got a good idea now. I've been in the game long enough. I know what does appeal to the audience. So as I've already said, Valley Blanche videos nearly always do well. I can't guarantee that one's going to go viral, but they're always going to perform reasonably strongly. And of course, now I've been doing the snow reports. I know that they're going to be consistently reasonably strong. They do have random spikes, sometimes quite big spikes up and down, and it varies to do with the weather and also the time of the year. So obviously around Christmas and around February, they're very popular. Right now, most people have lost interest. So unless something external happens to grab everyone's attention, like a huge snowstorm, people have stopped watching them now, unfortunately for me. That is the game that I'm well aware that's going to happen.
All skiing is seasonal to a certain degree. I mean, the snow reports are great because you are Chamonix ski bum, but we're talking about covering not just, as I mentioned before, let's say the Mont Blanc Unlimited Pass. You know, it'll take you to Les Contamines, Saint-Gervais, Megève, Courmayeur, and even to Verbier as well. And you cover all of those areas. So one of your snow reports, you know, might well focus on a certain area, but you tend to give an overall view of what's going on.
Yep, exactly. I can't be everywhere all the time. And being based close to Saint-Gervais, I'll do most of my on-the-mountain reporting from Saint-Gervais. But I'll still try and get to as many different areas in the week as I can. And the ones that I'm not visiting, I'll be watching friends' social media profiles and various other people's social media profiles to get an idea of what's going on. I'll be looking at the webcams. I'll be checking the snow reports from the company, the Mont Blanc, etc. So I always try and give a broad overview of all the areas, even if personally I'm just in one area at that particular point in time.
Can I ask some more, I don't know, technical questions? What camera or cameras do you use?
I've got two cameras which I use. The vast majority of it is on what is now a very old GoPro. I think it's a Hero 7 Silver, which is pretty bashed, pretty cracked and smashed up, but it still does the job. I like using that just for ease of use because it's small, it fits in the pocket, it doesn't weigh anything. I can just grab it out, start talking, hold it up and fire away. And then I've also got an Insta360 X4, which I was gifted a couple of seasons ago. They wanted me to do a review, so I did a number of videos for that. And I'll still use that, but it's much more faff to use. It's heavier, it's bigger, and the editing process takes much, much longer. So if there's really good snow, I'll take it out with me because I can then make some much more high quality videos with it. But it makes the whole process much slower, much longer. So most of the time I won't use that just out of convenience.
I actually have a similar combination as well. And I'm much more inclined to use my GoPro, which is a similar older model to yourself. The 360 camera is fantastic, but you have to get it onto a selfie stick. You have to work out, you know, where it's going to go. I've tried putting it in my backpack and experimented a bit. And it is a hassle. You've got to sort it out. And I found when I try to edit from it, the files are just massive. It really, you know, chews up my laptop.
Yeah, it's a real slow process. And in theory, the laptop which I have is made for editing photos and videos. It is a decent quality laptop. It still can't cope with the 360 files. They're just too big and too cumbersome. Even when I'm editing within the Insta360 suite, everything's very juddery and very kind of stop-start, which makes it hard to edit everything smoothly because you can't actually watch back the thing that you're trying to edit in real time.
On the other hand, it does give amazing footage. And, you know, a good example of that just recently was, I think, you posted a short of you going down the Arete on the Aiguille du Midi, which I presume was filmed with the 360 camera. And it just looks fantastic. If someone's listening and they've never done the Arete, that's a really good video to watch to give you an indication of what it's like, although presumably they probably wouldn't do it quite as fast as you did.
Well, indeed, I think I made that comment that it takes me just over 4 minutes from leaving the gate to skiing, which that would be physically impossible if there was other people on the arete for starters. I was up there at 2 in the afternoon and it was empty. I was almost running down the arete. You certainly won't be doing that if it's your first time up there.
For sure. And, you know, I also really enjoyed looking around at your channel. You know, you're not just covering snow sports, but you're covering, you know, wild swimming and cycling as well. I saw one of your videos was filmed down in Lake Passy, which is one of my favorite places. That's obviously one of your passions as well.
Yeah, absolutely. Partly it's out of necessity to be able to keep the channel going, have some momentum through the summer. I'm filming the things which I love doing. I'd be doing them regardless of whether I was filming them, so I may as well put some of them on the internet. I have many passions, and that is one of the joys of living in Chamonix, that you can do, sometimes even in the same day or the same week, you can do both summer and winter activities, and it's got the full spectrum. So that's why I'm here, and I like to share that.
I love that, and I think, you know, your passion for it definitely comes through. You also see your expressive personality, let's say, in some of the shirts that you wear. You've got a great selection of Hawaiian shirts that you've used in some of the videos. One of my favorites I saw was one with lots of little skiers on.
I'm definitely different, shall we say, in my attire that I wear on the mountains. You won't see anybody else who dresses like me, that's for sure.
Yeah, and shorts on a regular basis as well.
Yeah, I'm definitely someone who's very hot-blooded. I overheat quite easily anyway. And yeah, any excuse to get some board shorts out. And even on the Vallée Blanche, it might be -5 in the air temperature, but when you're in the sun and out the wind, it can feel pretty toasty up there. And especially if you're moving, you're generating a lot of body heat anyway. So yeah, I definitely like to get the legs out as much as I can.
Cool. I've really enjoyed our chat. I wondered maybe if you could summarize, I don't know if you can get it into a sentence or whatever, but what it is about Chamonix that makes it such a special destination for you?
Well, for me, as I say, it's because it is a true year-round destination. And it covers all your bases, from your summer mountaineering and climbing, the other sports, the cycling, the running, the swimming, and the obviously very extreme skiing in the winter as well. And indeed, if you really wanted to, you can ski year round. And being a ski bum, that's also a huge positive. So a way to summarize Chamonix is it's like Disneyland for adults. That's just the one liner you want to use.
I love that. I mean, some people would say it's the adrenaline capital or the adventure capital of the world, but I prefer your line there. That's brilliant, David. And, you know, all those things that you point out there, one of the reasons why, you know, I keep coming back here and why I've chosen to locate myself here just now. But, you know, I really appreciate you giving me your time today. I'm going to put links in the show notes. So, you know, listener, if you've never checked out David's channel, Chamonix Ski Bum, and you're coming out to Chamonix or Lake Antimine or Saint-Gervais or any of the surrounding areas, I highly recommend that you have a look at it. That's brilliant, David. Thanks so much.
Thanks so much for having me.
I hope you enjoyed this look at another aspect of Chamonix. I love getting feedback from our listeners. If you enjoyed this episode or you have any comments, please do let me know. You can do that by leaving a comment on Spotify, Instagram or Facebook, or drop me an email to theskipodcast@gmail.com. We're also on WhatsApp. I release exclusive material there ahead of each episode. Look in the show notes for all those links. I have had feedback from several listeners since our last episode. James Rice said, "Love the podcast. It's absolutely indispensable for me and I must listen every week." Great to hear, James. Louise Cotter said, "I am really enjoying the Chamonix series. The OCAP," as she referring to episode 316 there, "is awesome." And Max Martin, no relation, gave us a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts. Thank you, Max. He said, "High quality and high interest on all things skiing. Just listen to the Chamonix special. Well worth a subscribe." There are now 317 episodes of the Ski Podcast to catch up with, and 124 of those were listened to in the last week alone. If you, listener, are in one of those places in the world that is unseasonably warm right now and you'd like to get some winter in your life, then just go to theskipodcast.com, have a search around the tags and categories, and you're bound to find an episode of interest to listen to. And if you did enjoy this episode and you'd like to support the podcast, you are very welcome to buy me a coffee at buymeacoffee.com/theskipodcast. Right, I'll be back next week. We're going to take a break from our Chamonix stories with a regular episode in which I'll be joined by Shemi Alcott, who is taking us behind the scenes of her time at the Winter Olympics. Until then, listener, thank you for joining us wherever in the world you're listening right now. And until next time, goodbye.